This presentation was delivered as part of the 2012 Boston Mormon Stories Conference held at Harvard Square in Cambridge, Massachusetts, as organized by the awesome Boston Mormon Stories Support Community. To start or join a support community where you live, click on the Support Communities menu option at mormonstories.org. To plan and host your own Mormon Stories Conference, please email us at mormonstories@gmail.com. And thank you for listening.
Thanks, everyone. We're going to get started again here with the second session. If we can all find some seats. My name is Danielle Mooney. I'm conducting this second session. I live here in Boston with my husband, and we're members of Boston First Ward. I would like to start actually with a big thank you to Liz, who conducted the first session, one for conducting, but two also because Liz made all of those pies that we all just ate. Every single one. And what I had was fantastic. So thanks very much, Liz. I know that she put a lot of work into doing that. I have a couple housekeeping-esque announcements. First of all, I would like to direct your attention to the insert in the programs. It lists, in addition to listing the social tomorrow, it also lists several worship options in the area if you don't have a place to go or you are interested in trying a new worship experience. And so if you would like to attend one of those services, if you would find the people connected with that, so specifically Tom Goodsell, for example, is the Community of Christ contact. And I think that if nobody's interested, he is probably not going to make the trip out to Lexington himself tomorrow. So if you want to go, he's happy to do that, but do let him know so that if you want someone there with you who knows the lay of the land, he can plan on doing that for you. And Liz is the point person for Cambridge First Ward if you're interested in going there. Also listed is a service here. We don't have a point person for that, but hopefully you could find your way back if you're interested in coming here tomorrow for services. Also, I'd like to point out that we have Mormon Story pass-along cards in the great tradition of Mormon propaganda. And so if you are interested in learning more specifically about our local Boston Mormon Stories group, there's the Facebook URL for our local group on there, and also our newly founded Twitter account. So you can get information about the various events that we host, typically in the form of potlucks, because we would love to see more of you all again. We're going to open this session with another song from Mark Abernathy, his last performance for the day.
A song or two songs? What would you like?
Of green.
Thank you so much, Mark. That was absolutely beautiful.
I still got 15 CDs left, so my wife will kill me if I don't get rid of them.
It is now my pleasure to introduce our next speaker, Joanna Brooks. She's joining us all the way from San Diego, where she lives with her husband and two daughters. She's the chair of the Department of English and Comparative Literature at San Diego State University, and she's become a well-recognized commentator on Mormon life and politics. Joanna is also the author of several books, including most recently, The Book of Mormon Girl, Stories from an American Faith. Her writing can also be found, for those of you who would like to read more of it. in the online magazine, Religion Dispatches, where she's a regular contributor, and on her question and answer blog, Ask Mormon Girl. Thanks for joining us, Joanna.
I feel like the shortest person who stood at this podium today. Mormons reduce tall people, not my family. Thank you to Tom and Liz, the pie maker, and Anne, and everyone who made today happen in this beautiful space, and to Laurel. Such an honor to follow you. Well, I guess I've been sort of following you my whole life, so this is very, very appropriate. And to John for the beautiful, very heartfelt, very real remarks. And Mark, who I listen to on my iPod all the time. And I was thinking when you were singing, where are you, just now, that, and someone will know this better than me because this is Cambridge. I think the Hebrew word for breath and soul are the same. It's like ruach. Does anyone know? Oh, I know something. Okay, good. And so I was thinking about how beautiful, it's so great to feel the soul breathe back, you know, into some of these beautiful hymns that just, so thank you for that. Mormon Stories conferences are super fun, and I've got to go to a bunch of them in the last year. They're this wonderful innovation, and they all have these different themes. And in some places, the theme is, hey, I'm freaking out. And in some places, the theme is, meet the misfit Mormons like you. And when I said to Anne, I said, well, what's the theme? What do you want me to come talk on? What's the theme of the Boston conference? She said, using personal narratives to create spaces where Mormons of all levels of orthodoxy can interact authentically. And I said, really? And she's like, yeah, this is Boston. You know, you gotta bring your A game. And I said, well, Boston, that's why we love you. Not only are you crying in church on a Saturday afternoon when the sun is shining, but, you know, you're the home of Exponent 2 and the fabled Cambridge Ward. And I tell you, you know, Laurel Thatcher Ulrich is your Sunday school teacher. And you should know every Sunday across the whole United States of America, there are liberal Mormons dreaming of the Cambridge Ward, sitting in their own gospel doctrine classes like this. And they're dreaming of you here in the chosen place. And now you have every political reporter in America crawling all over you, and every inch of the Belmont Ward has just been scoped out. Judy Dusky's phone is reading off the hook 24 hours a day. You poor things, the eyes of the nation are upon you for the next 6 or 7 months. Bless your hearts. And, you know, I've actually spent a lot of my life thinking about Boston and this area, too, because I'm actually an early American literary historian by training, and you're going to hear some things I'm going to cover. Like, I've read the Shepherd. I feel like I'm reporting to my graduate school professor. I read the Shepherd Confessions. I really did. So a big chunk of my PhD studies focused on New England Protestantism. So here we are. I was in LA thinking about Boston for many years. And so I'm going to, forgive me as I take you back to graduate school with me for a little while, because I want to think about, you know, this using personal narratives to create spaces where Mormons of all levels of orthodoxy can interact authentically. So about 400 years ago, the people who colonized this area, they dedicated a lot of their resources to telling stories and to this question of how to craft a spiritual narrative. And it was a very serious question for them, because in order to attend and become a member of a local church, as Laurel indicated, not just an attender, but a member, you had to give a narrative of your faith, and you had to give it to either to the congregation or to the minister. And they were recorded in manuscript. They've survived the centuries. And you had to be very careful about how you crafted your story. It wasn't a casual affair. It was very serious business, because each of the different congregations had a different minister who had their own special stamp on what conversion actually looked like. These elaborate conversion morphologies. I mean, they were like, you know, stealing Indian corn hidden in the ground, and at the same time writing like 600-page tracts about whether you felt grace before you acted in grace. You know, like big, huge scholarly treatises, and they're barely surviving. And you know, each congregation believed that a proper conversion took a very particular shape, that God moved within individuals, directing their experience and consciousness in some very specific ways. And it was crucial to separate, like, what was in your imagination or what was your own human will from your own flesh, from the actual workings of God in your life, in order to understand your spiritual state. Good, Laurel's nodding. I got it right so far. Passed my grad exams. And it's amazing to think about these communities, like really on the edge of survival, dedicating this much intellectual and spiritual labor to the crafting of stories. I mean, really meticulously crafted. And because the goal, when you told your story, was not just to make people cry. It was to demonstrate that your experiences conformed to this template that your minister put forward. So you had to really examine and find that the shape of your experience fit the shape that your minister taught you that God worked through. God was understood to be legible in the events of individual lives, but God was also understood to be legible in the events of community lives. So these collectively experienced events like earthquakes and political controversies and everything, God was sort of legible in it all. And for a few decades, at least, people tried to interpret the entire history of New England settlements as like one big God story. Here's what God was saying to us through this event or that event. But that was hard to do for more than a few decades because life gets really complicated, you know, and you look at the strange shaped vegetable and you're like, I don't think I could see God here. I'm not sure what to do with it. And the world of the Puritans grew more complicated and the settlements grew. They developed actually suburbs, early suburbs were a source of spiritual crises. And it sort of stressed this tightly woven sense of intimate story. And the population was growing more diverse. There were working class Irish people who were coming over, working class English who were totally unchurched and you know, people who were not Puritans, you know, moving to build the economy. Local native peoples were converting to Christianity. The kids and the grandkids of the original Puritan settlers were not quite as into the religion as their grandparents were. And still, their parents all wanted them to belong. And so the communities were dealing with these new stresses about how to tell a collective story that still conveyed the sense of God being in dialogue with this people. And so by the late 17th century, even these very dedicated missionaries kind of thrown up their hands. They're like, I'm not sure we can really tell a collective story anymore in which we can clearly see God's workings in our midst. In the 18th century, it got much, much worse. New England transformed from this little Puritan outpost to like a port on this transatlantic world, and all of a sudden you had entirely new populations of people moving through, from you know indigenous people who were sailors moving all points in the Atlantic to peoples from Africa who had been displaced and were captive labor, and they converted to Christianity. They would infuse Christianity with their own indigenous backgrounds, and there was population growth, and there were immigrants. And natural increase even grew the amount of people beyond the number of churches they were. So in many areas, people were actually ministering to themselves. And there was technological change, right? The printing press actually happened, and there was more than one. and that meant that print was really available to people. So there started to be newspapers and people started printing their own stories and printing their own hymnals. And anyone who could afford to either pay the printer or like convince the printer that their story would sell, I have a really good one, you want to print it, it'll sell some copies, they had access to media. And so all of these changes, social changes, economic changes, political changes, they changed the way people thought about God in their lives. They changed the way people thought about their own stories. And in fact, they contributed to this religious movement that historians sometimes call the Great Awakening, which was also a lot of it happened right here, like a lot of everything happens here. It's not the case in San Diego, where there's nothing ever happened in San Diego, allegedly. But, you know, so they had these huge revivals that attracted even more unchurched people and people of color and working class people and women. And all of a sudden, the science of telling your conversion story just sort of fell away. And the stories reoriented. And what all these stories people in the 18th century had in common was this notion that there's this big dramatic change in your life, right? There's this huge change. And all the stories, that took center stage. And the revivals became fairly spectacular because not only did people talk about changes, but they experienced them like right there at the revivals. And you knew it because they were falling down or shouting out or, you know, shaking. And so there was this really rather dramatic revising of spiritual narrative. And a lot of times maybe it was some indigenous American or indigenous African influences that were shaping the way even white Christians were telling their stories, notions of spirit possession. And this whole class of like very carefully educated Puritan preachers who had such precise notions about what a story should look like kind of moved to the sideline. And there's this whole class of lay preachers who came up instead who may have not even gone to college. And yeah, if they could tell a really good story, people would listen to them and would gather around. And they worked the edges of revival crowds and they printed their own stories and sold their own stories.
And so there was this kind of roiling democratic Christianity with its this emphasis on change, turbulent, destructive, dynamic change. And it really made sense, because if you think about the 18th century, it's this time of just huge change, and people's lives are being uprooted and moved around the Atlantic world, and they're separated from their original continents and from their families. And what else could they say? You know, I've experienced a mighty change. I've been born again. The old me is dead. The new me is alive. I once was lost, but now I'm found. I mean, that's where that formula gets born. It's born in the 18th century, in the middle of catastrophe, and this remodeling of Christianity to reflect these catastrophic lives. And so after the Great Awakening, telling your story becomes far less about disciplining it to fit in this precise orthodox form and more about sharing stories as a religious experience in itself. And what made stories powerful was their humanity, was oftentimes this like stark confrontation with danger, uncertainty, vulnerability, and the sense of coming to the other side of something. That's what made stories work. And these narratives became places where more or people of all levels of orthodoxy could interact authentically. And the Great Awakening left these genres of American story. I'm giving Anna Rash for the theme. That's all right. This formula, this narrative formula, it gets discovered in the 18th century. This I once was lost and now I'm found formula just stays with us to the rest of American history. Think about it. It's the basis for the 19th century slave narrative, right? I was once enslaved and now I'm free. And slaves sold and told their stories as a way of raising money for and building the movement, the abolitionist movement. Virtually all of the 19th century reform movements, from reform to temperance, all of it had these conversion-like stories about improvements in human lives. In the 20th century, of course, feminists gathered in consciousness-raising groups. And what did we do? We told our stories. And we talked about these moments, these of dramatic change. Ms. Magazine called it the click. Do you know this term, the click? When all of a sudden you see, you didn't see, but now you see gender inequality all around you. And recently we've seen this whole new genre of LGBT narrative, the It Gets Better narrative, right? It gets better. I once was lost, now I'm found. And so there's this deep and longstanding connection in American life between telling your story and building community. And Mormons actually have done this for a long time very well. I think really few religious communities do personal story the way that Mormons do. And I've been to some others. I've even been to some unprogrammed traditions like the Society of Friends or Quakers, you know, where it's sort of a lot in common with a Mormon testimony meeting, but the shape of the stories are different. I mean, our faith is really a religion of converts. And it's forged in the crucible, the Second Great Awakening. And we've always understood, you know, the power of personal story. It's always been super important. And the reason I told you all that prehistory, all that early American stuff, is not just because we're here. But I think, too, that we might be witnessing a sort of a parallel shift in Mormon stories. You know, sort of the 17th century to the 18th century model. And it's a shift that sort of threatens but also promises to remake our sense of what it means to be Mormon. The middle decades of the 20th century in Mormonism, if you saw Matt Bowman's really sharp piece on correlation in Slate the other day, you know, we saw, you know, after sort of a wild and woolly 19th century, this disciplining of public expressions of Mormonism in the 20th century with correlation, both internally and for the public. So, you know, boiling it down and making sure we have sort of coherent formulaic answers and a coordinated curriculum. And this once expansive and speculative theology gets boiled down into these theological keywords that we're sure everyone learns in the same way from the cradle to the grave. And this was important, right? Because we had a worldwide missionary program trying to teach the gospel and also trying to kind of get everyone on the same page and appear to be normal modern Americans. And, you know, although I haven't seen scholarship on this, but there's this wonderful book called Still the Small Voice, which looks at, as a folklorist, actually looks like how Mormons talk to each other and talk about the spirit. I wonder how correlation affected the way we bore our testimonies. I haven't seen any scholarship about it. I wonder what a testimony in the 1930s would sound like compared to a testimony in the 1980s. It would be interesting. To be sure, there's still, if you go to testimony, I mean, you'll still hear some truly uncorrelated stories. A few months ago, I mean, there's always the I lost the check and God found it for me. And a few months ago, someone somehow bore testimony in my ward of San Diego Gas and Electric's home energy conservation program. Someone bore testimony of that in my ward. We're all anticipating a stream of Romney monies this fall because we sure saw Proposition 8 timonies in Southern California a few years ago. And that's to be expected. Public storytelling is a way that a community processes major collective events. But on matters of faith, there's a tacit understanding in many regions of the Mormon world that a testimony appropriate to fast and testimony, meaning, is one that ends with conventional statements of belief assent, an affirmation that one knows the church is true, in that phrase, right? An affirmation of the prophetic calling of Joseph Smith, the divinity and the historicity of the Book of Mormon, or at least its literal veracity, or the atonement of Jesus Christ. And that's to be expected, too, because public storytelling is a way the communities affirm the reality of their core truths, their orthodoxies. But I wonder if we might not be witnessing now in this moment, and especially in this Mormon Stories project, a shift parallel that happened to the shift that happened in the 18th century in America. We've had out-migration from the Mormon culture region. We've had the global growth of the church. These have changed the LDS community. They've opened us up to global influences, even as we've established a more international and cosmopolitan sense of what it means to be a Mormon. Just like in the 18th century, we've had some pretty dramatic technological change. So, digital media has really shifted control over the Mormon narrative away from institutional authorities and just to just about anybody with a laptop, a good story, and a domain name. If the theory once held that a Mormon personal narrative should demonstrate sort of this orthodox adherence to convention, there's a competing theory that the articulation of powerful experience can connect one to the collective regardless of level of orthodoxy. And we've seen this take shape even in the church's own Mormon.org campaign, where you get these kind of fascinating public stories, and all they need to say at the end is, "And I'm a Mormon, and it's a Mormon story." We've seen it in Kendall Wilcox's amazing BYU version of It Gets Better. And this is the premise of the Mormon Stories Project, right? Very simple. Mormonism engenders powerful experiences of many kinds. And in sharing those experiences, we affirm our relationship to the tradition, even if our experiences and that relationship is not orthodox. So I won't say that what we're doing is entirely new. I will say I think technology has given unorthodox storytelling an entirely new platform and reach. It's created whole new communities virtually out of thin air, witness like the Facebook groups and the Blogger and Ackle. And why these venues matter is that they give Mormons an access to a kind of community we might feel cut off from on Sundays or in fast and testimony meetings where more orthodox conventions of expression are still observed. Still in the first year of the Mormon Stories Communities and Conferences Project, I think we've all learned that no community can be entirely without rules and conventions. We've really struggled as a Mormon Stories community to serve people who felt that they can't express themselves authentically in their families or local wards and yet remain a space that is welcoming for people who identify as active and believing. And that's just an ongoing conversation of how to do that. There have been extremely charged insider-outsider boundaries in Mormonism for more than 150 years. And those charged boundaries impact the way we speak to each other every day in this setting with our own Mormon families, in our wards, and not always for the good, So we live with that charged boundary, that sense of how you speak and whether that classifies you as belonging or not belonging. And it shaped the way we live our lives. So, for our part in Mormon Stories, among the shared values, we've taken pains to include the statement that we acknowledge and honor different spiritual paths and modes of religious or non-religious truth seeking. We respect the convictions of those who subscribe to ideas and beliefs that differ from our own. And this is something that needs to apply not only to people who are unorthodox or non-believing or atheistic and want to be able to say that in a Mormon community, but to those who are believing as well. Like, everyone needs to have a space to tell their story. Now, in the last few months, I've had the wonderful experience of publishing, self-publishing my book, The Book of Mormon Girl. And in it, I wrote a little bit about the challenge of writing an unorthodox Mormon story. And I'll read just a few paragraphs where I talk about it there. I grew up riding in fleets of blue paneled family vans, bench seats loaded with children, all going to church in our play clothes on a Wednesday afternoon. Everything perfectly understood among us, all the lyrics memorized, nothing to be explained. I grew up in a world where all the stories I heard arrived at the same conclusions. The wayfarer restored, the sick healed, the lost keys found, a singular truth confirmed. And an Orthodox Mormon story is the only kind of story I ever wanted to be able to tell. But these are not the kinds of stories life has given me. Every Mormon carries with them a bundle of stories like a suitcase of family secrets, polygamous ancestors we have learned to be ashamed of, histories that reveal the human flaws of the ones who came before us, doctrines we dare not mention in public for fear of ridicule, sacrifices we refuse to believe that God would ask of us, stories of loss that do not end neatly with restoration, and stories of leaving that do not conclude with the return home. In the world I grew up in, it was not okay to tell unorthodox stories. We didn't hear them in church, we didn't read them in scripture, but sooner or later, they break through to the surface of every Mormon life, every human life, every life of faith. I'm not afraid of them, because this is the story life has given me to tell. And really, the story I tell in the Book of Mormon Girl is not a remarkable story at all. It's an American coming-of-age story. It's a story about growing up in a faith you love and then becoming an adult and facing complications that come to every life of faith. It's a story about leaving behind innocence, about having a spiritual home, losing that home, and then sort of reconstructing that home for yourself. It's a story that most contemporary people of faith just intuitively get. And I tried in the Book of Mormon Girl to be very plain about my own vulnerabilities. I wrote about childhood insecurities. I wrote about body issues. I'm no Marie Osmond. You know, I wrote about coming of age rights. I wrote about sexuality. I wrote about abuse, you name it. And I did so, again, not because these are remarkable or unique stories. Quite to the contrary. I did so because I know that experiences like these are so very common among Mormon men and women. Among human beings, they are as common as grass, a friend of mine told me. And for women especially, so much of our spiritual energy and power is sapped every day and redirected by issues dealing with our bodies. Like if I ever post just a little thing on Facebook that says, body issues suck, like the like button turns purple, you know, just from someone pressing this. Yes, I hear you. And these matters are a quiet, constant drain on our individual and collective spiritual energies. And yet, as luminous as 19th century Mormon theology was on the body, such theologies have yet to penetrate the self-loathing so very many Mormon women feel. I wrote about these vulnerable matters that deal with the body, not because I'm weak, but because I'm actually strong, not because I'm sick, because I'm actually well. I'm well and strong enough to tell a story that remains largely unaddressed and unredressed in our community. But because I talked about these quietly harmful realities, as well as about very common crises points for all people of faith who wrestle with institutional religion, gender conservatism, homophobia, political and theological retrenchment, as well as some crisis points peculiar to the Mormon experience like polygamy, my story has engendered a little bit of pushback and some of it sort of grouchy. And there's some great joke. I wish you, never mind. There's some good, I have a 6-year-old who, you know, my 6 and my 8-year-old live with me, of course, and they see things, and sometimes they come up and they're looking on the Facebook and they're interpreting things, and they come up with names for people, like translucidated names for people whose names they see appearing in my life. And so, what the heck? My 6-year-old spent a few weeks talking about mouth rock and roll. If you can figure out who that was. There's some K's in someone's life. Anyway, so grouchy pushback kind of person she named Mouth Rock and Roll, who had made mommy cry and she wanted to punish him. But I'd say in addition to this rather grouchy pushback, there's been a great deal of positive feedback and reception and love. But I think the pushback is instructive. I think it's important because it has been public and because it's aimed to sort of stigmatize and wound and shame and belittle rather than engage and understand. And so why? Why the force of this reaction? So I'll end with four conclusions. First, it is still very powerful to tell an unorthodox story in Mormonism. Second, it's even more powerful for a Mormon woman to assume an unorthodox form of public authority. Still kind of a deal. Third, Mormons are terrified of being vulnerable in public. We cry certain times, but in other ways, we're terrified. After so many years of being the object of ridicule and misunderstanding, we have taught ourselves to carefully discipline our public speech to deflect unwanted kinds of attention and to promote only carefully managed versions of our story. Really, you know, every member missionary put it out there. In this context, revealing one's vulnerabilities as a Mormon is an act of tremendous peril and power. And then fourth and finally, in the spirit of storytelling, we need about 50 more Book of Mormon girls. We need so many more stories, stories upon stories. We need your story, all of your stories, because if my story as a straight, married, believing, but sort of doctrinally agnostic on a few things, mostly observant, Sunday school teaching mother of two can engender pushback, we have a lot of work to do. In telling our personal narratives with dignity, candor, and respect, there is the power to build community, the power to say, you are not alone, I am not alone, let none of us feel alone in this tradition. It is in our collective Mormon stories that the future of the faith is being written. And now it's your turn. We want to hear from you. Thank you.
So, like Joanna mentioned, this is the part of today where we're going to open the floor to everyone and invite you all to come up and share your stories in the tradition of Mormon testimony meetings. But it's a little different here. All are welcome to share, and all levels of belief and disbelief are equally welcome and valid. In fact, it is by agreeing to disagree on our varied faith and unfaith that we'll be able to transcend those differences and build community bonds that are stronger than whether or not we share exactly the same prototype of belief. I just want to also remind all of you who might like to share that this is being recorded for podcast. So just FYI, be aware. And also so that as many of us as possible can participate, I'd like to ask that you try to keep your remarks concise. So in the tradition of Mormon testimony meeting, since I'm conducting, I get to kick this off. And I guess I'd like to start by saying that my Mormonism is founded and constructed around the two foundational tenets that Joseph Smith identified, namely friendship and truth. I believe that truth can be found everywhere through the whole diversity of human experience, through all traditions of faith, through all areas of science and research. I think that truth very much is much like its scriptural counterpart, light. We can find it anywhere, and in differing degrees of brightness, some places it might be rather dim, but there are things there that we can find. And while our human sight is necessarily limited to these great truths, there's no way we could collect all the light into our limited human eyes. We, I think, gather what we can and try to carry that little glow around us. And that's the kind of truth-seeking that my childhood and adolescence in Mormonism led me to. I grew up in Minnesota in a Mormon family. My mom was a convert. She converted when she met my dad. And my fondest memories of our religious discussions as I grew up was my mom taking my sister and I in bed with her at night and describing to us our heavenly family and telling us that we had a heavenly father who loved us incomprehensibly perfectly and entirely and forever and ever, and that we had a brother just like I had a sister, but who was also perfect and who loved us beyond our understanding and who died for us so that we could all be together again. And that I had, in addition to him, innumerable brothers and sisters, and they were all around us. That my mother herself was even actually my sister, in that she was a daughter of God and the Father that we shared in heaven. And I loved that narrative. It was so safe and cozy to me. My whole childhood was this safe family place that I always felt that I had. When I was 10 or 11, I remember that we sang, "Oh, My Father," in church. And that was the first time that the lyric about Heavenly Mother jumped out at me. And so after church, I brought that up to my mom, and because I'd never heard it before, this idea that in addition to this father and brother that I had been taught about and these innumerable brothers and sisters, that I had a mother. And she told me that was in fact true, and then she thought it was a beautiful doctrine. And we didn't really get into it beyond that, but that night when I crawled into my bed and pulled the covers up around me, I said a prayer to Heavenly Father, and I said, "Today, my mom told me that I have a mother in heaven, too, just like you. And I didn't know that before, but I really like it. And so I would like to talk to her, if that's okay." And I felt this feeling that that I should absolutely go ahead. And so I said in my little pre-adolescent childhood innocence, "Hi." And I immediately felt an overwhelming rush of love. And I felt cradled by a mother and a father who were infinitely loving and infinitely present in my life. And I didn't really have anything else to say. I was just glad she was there. And I fell asleep just praying, saying that I didn't have anything else to say, but I would just like to keep this feeling for as long as I could, for as long as I was awake. And I didn't do much with that experience, I guess, throughout my adolescence. It just sort of existed in my back pocket. I knew she was there, and I knew he was there, and I had them. But as I came into adulthood, this idea of being a woman got a lot more complicated, actually, than it even was when I was a teenager, and it became abundantly clear to me that there is actually not a right way to do this being a human woman. That you're supposed to fit in box one, but if you could simultaneously fit into box two, that would be great, and if you don't, we're going to have some problems. And her presence has become much more important to me, and has become in equal measure with my father and with my brother. Interestingly, nobody told me that I wasn't allowed to pray to her until I was in college. And I heard about the Hinckley comments and the injunction against prayer to her, and I easily rejected it out of hand. One, because I've never had a problem with rejecting authority figures, which my parents really appreciated, I'm sure, throughout my entire life. But also because my house is not motherless, and I refuse to pretend that it is, and I refuse to live in a motherless house. And I refuse to deny this fundamentally Mormon doctrine that I have a mother and a father with a body in heaven, and that they love me infinitely, and that they sent their son, who is my brother, to save me and all of my brothers and sisters. The other uniquely Mormon doctrine that I deeply love is the idea of Zion. I find such beauty in this idea that we're saved by Christ's grace individually, but we are exalted together. And through the perfection of our relationships. And I believe in the work of building Zion, a place without enmity and of pure equality. And I believe that we are perfected through the work of love. And I don't think we'll ever finish this building and this working and this striving without Christ and our heavenly parents at our head. But I think that we're supposed to try. And I think we're supposed to try hard. And those are the things that I believe, and those are the things that I love so deeply about this church and the tradition I grew up with. I'd now like to turn the time over to the rest of you, and I think we'll go until just after 4. So any of you who feel inclined to share, please do so. Thanks.
Hello. It is by chance that I am here. I am actually, my name is Michelle Eakin. I live in Columbia, Maryland, just outside of Baltimore, in between Baltimore and D.C. I'm here at a pediatric academic conference at the convention center, and in looking at my guide, realized I had nothing to do this afternoon, and I saw Joanna Brooks posting that she was here in Boston. I said, why don't I go? And so I'm here. And this morning I went to a session, and they were talking about healthcare transitions, and they put it in the context that of the life course theory. This is what they talk about at these conferences, that there's sensitive periods when we're all going through transitions, and they were talking about transitioning from pediatric medical care to adult care. And I realized that it's nice to think about it for healthcare, but I think even more important, there are adult and faith transitions, and it is a sensitive period. And what they notice in the pediatric research is that during these transitions, these adolescents, emerging young adults, have higher hospitalization rates, and they're not adherent, and they're kind of the patients their doctors just pull their hair out about. And I said, well, that's what my faith transition was. I was that patient. I was non-adherent. I didn't go to church. I made major life mistakes. I wear those scars proudly now, because that was my transition. And that's where I am now. And it really took another transition to bring me to where I am, and I think there will be more transitions to come. And that was motherhood, was where I think I found another huge transition in my life. And having the ability to make a person, it's kind of incredible. But then to be charged with that task of raising that person, it's even more incredible. And when I realized is I needed a community, and I needed an identity. My maiden name is Nuttall. For those who are in no Mormon history, my great-great-grandfather was Leonard John Nuttall, and he was executive secretary to Taylor. And as my dad puts it, we were on the wrong side of the polygamous wives and ended up getting no money when the church and the state had to separate everything out. So true Mormon history and culture. And as I went through my faith transition, I disregarded it. Said, I can't be a Mormon. And in fact, when people would ask me, oh, you're from Utah, you must be from Mormon. Oh, you went to BYU, you have to be Mormon. I'd be like, well, no, not really. I denied it. And I realized, why am I denying my Mormonism when the person sitting right next to me that hasn't been to Catholic Church or the Jewish synagogue or whatever in like 20 years proudly claims being a Catholic? And then I said, I am a Mormon. I'm not practicing, but I am a Mormon. And I will always be a Mormon. And My children now are Mormons. Now, I married out of the church, and my husband is actually a member of the Disciples of Christ, which is another kind of splinter Christian group, which we can talk, you know, think about. But he has committed to me, I guess because he didn't have a strong opinion and I did, I think, that we raise our children Mormon. And so he is a saint and comes every week to church, except for open mic night. He does ask, at open mic Sundays, he does ask that we sit home. And he's just couldn't handle those. And I respect it. And to the point that I'm actually out of town tomorrow and my husband just texted me, Doug wants to go to primary, so we're going to go to primary, and then afterwards we're going to go do a picnic at the park. And I realize every week that we go to church, and I stand there as a Mormon married to a non-member, faculty at a Johns Hopkins Medical School, and my husband comes and supports me. I am making my story known. And I think that's difficult for me. In fact, coming up here is a little intimidating and seeing that recorder there. And I had a beautiful image given to me recently at a negotiating workshop at Johns Hopkins about how I can get more money. But it was this woman who was saying that women, we don't negotiate for ourselves. We're not good advocates for ourselves. In fact, we're terrible. Men, they can negotiate for themselves a lot better than women. But you know where women are better? So we negotiate better for another person. We are 75th percentile for that, 25th for ourselves. And she said, you need to think about yourself as not just identifying for yourself, but for all the women that have come before you. And I include in there my mother, my sisters, my ancestors, and all the women that come in front of me, after me, my daughter, my granddaughters. And I need to stand up and say, I am a Mormon, and I do come to church, and I have a place there, and you'll have to forgive me. I am going to read one of my favorite scriptures for the Book of Mormon that, you know, speaks to me in my presence and my testimony. I love the Book of Mormon. It is another testament of Christ. We can talk about the historical sensations. In fact, I don't even care about the historic because I just don't go there. I believe in Stephen Jay Gould, who actually is here at Harvard. He said it best, that people of goodwill wish to see science and religion at peace. I do not see how science and religion could be unified or even synthesized under any common scheme of explanation or analysis. But I don't understand why the two enterprises should experience any conflict. I believe that's true. We don't have to make it. It's the Rock of Ages and the Ages of Rocks. They don't have to come together. Anyways, aside, going back to my scriptures, and I no longer have my scriptures memorized, so we'll just have to bear with me. 3 Nephi, chapter 18. This is when Jesus, my favorite part of the Book of Mormon, when Jesus appears to the Americans, and he's about to leave. And these are the things he says. Chapter 18, verse 22. And behold, ye shall meet together oft, and you shall not forbid any man or woman from coming unto you when you shall meet together. But suffer them that they may come unto you and forbid them not. Therefore, hold up your light that it may shine unto the world. Behold, I am the light which you shall hold up, that which you have seen me do. Behold, ye see that I have prayed unto the Father, and ye have all witnessed. And ye see that I have commanded that none of you should go away, but rather have commanded that you should come unto me, that you might feel and see. Even so shall ye do unto the world. And I know everyone's on their own phase transitions and your own critical periods. That's my story. Thank you.
I'm glad somebody found the tissue box. My name's Emily. I'm here from San Diego. I came a long way. I'm grateful for this excuse to come visit Boston. I wanted to share a Mormon story. I have several of them. But this one is, I guess, the most recent or maybe reoccurring, revisiting in my own faith transitions, which I describe as constantly undulating and not going away anytime soon. But currently in my ward, I serve in the young women's. And there's one of our girls, her name is Piper, and she has been in foster care since she was 4 years old. I have no idea how or why she sought out our church, and she started coming to church, and I believe she had some memories of being brought to LDS Church when she was young by her grandmother. And I took her home from a mutual activity recently, and she described her hopes and dreams to me, and she talked about how she wants to become a veterinarian, and she wants to open up her own pet store, and it's going to be like no other, she said. And she talked about having a hospital connected to this pet store, and also a pet hotel that's going to be like above the pet store. And she just has this real love for animals. And she started talking about how aggressive animals shouldn't be put down. She's very passionate. She wants to close down the pound. And as I'm sure some of you are catching on here, there's the metaphor, you know, for her own life. I pulled into her group home. It's across the street from a hospital. It's next to some services to help get transition kids from foster care out on their own. And she talked about, you know, how much love she had for these animals. And I felt glad that she was able to, you know, have these dreams and have so much love to share. At the same time, I don't understand why she has had to suffer in her life. I don't understand why she was born in the situation that she was born in, and why I was born into mine. And, you know, people at church will say something about the preexistence, and I don't buy it, as I'm sure, you know, some of you don't either. And so that part causes a lot of frustration and anger and resentment. But at the same time, she's found a family and a home within Mormonism. And I think that her story is maybe represents some of our stories on a broader level. We might have a lot of anger or resentment about certain things, but yet we still find home and family within Mormonism. And I just wanted to share that with you and have that story be incorporated within all of our Mormon stories as they kind of create this mosaic of this Mormon experience that we're all a part of. And I want to thank everybody for putting on this program. It's been amazing, and thank you all for being here.
Excuse me. Hello, my name's Carrie Krall. I just got in on a red-eye flight from San Francisco, and I was interviewing for a prestigious LGBT scholarship. And my story at the scholarship, I think one of the reasons that they are so interested in me is I am one of the gay Mormons. And it's so interesting to me. When I went there as a BYU grad, I thought that that would just make them feel sorry for me. But turns out it actually made it so I was in the majority. Out of the 20 board members I met for the scholarship, 3 of them attended BYU and are ex-Mormon gay men. And I actually had an in with the LGBT scholarship committee because I went to Brigham Young University. So I definitely think something about that is it gets better for sure. the community that Mormonism has. I think that's what that, to me, testifies to, that people who are then ostracized from that community or feel the need to withdraw, that they still need a community similar to that, and they still need to be involved in order to find that same sense of meaning that they felt and was given to them very easily and very freely in the structure and the belief of the Mormon Church. I think something I've struggled with a lot in the last year is realizing that nothing I will do in my life will ever feel as significant to me as just praying or just reading my scriptures felt when I was a believing Mormon. Those things always felt eternally significant. And today, when I do things, I have to constantly be asking myself, is this a good use of my time? Is this helping me reach my goals? Is this going to benefit other people? And it can be almost a paralyzing question to have to ask about everything you do. I do not want to be crying right now. When I stood in front of this scholarship committee to kind of explain about my story and my history and why I might deserve a scholarship from them, it was the most stressful experience of my life. I just went through the experience of interviewing for medical school, and it was nothing compared to this interview. And I think one of the reasons is a lot of the questions that I was being asked about were about my Mormon tradition. They were fascinated by my mission. They kept asking questions about my mission. They couldn't stop. It took me a full 2 minutes of my 30 minutes allotted time to explain to a very prominent lesbian woman on this committee how having a companion on my mission was different than being gay. She just couldn't understand. and so I it just very much brought these two worlds that I've been walking a tightrope down the middle for a long time together. When I was getting ready for this interview and I was putting on the clothes I was going to wear, I'm looking at myself in the mirror and asking if I was ready for this. I realized I was wearing a tie for my mission. And that made me ask, what else am I bringing to this interview from my mission and from my Mormon background? And there were a lot of wonderful things I was able to answer that question with. And I want to just close by, I'm very grateful for Mormon Stories and for this community. Sometimes when I go to pray, I feel guilty. Sometimes when I go to love somebody, I feel guilty. And that's very difficult for me to reconcile why I feel guilty doing both of those things. But I think that this is kind of healing the water for me, helping me realize that there's still a place to go, or I can still drink from these streams that I know and are familiar, and that they can be good for me. And that's it.
My name is Lisa. I'm from all around, but I come from a multi-generational Mormon family. I have an ancestor that knew Joseph Smith and helped to print off the first copies of the Book of Mormon. They crossed the plains as pioneers, and they settled the state of Utah. And it's a heritage that has always given me strength, that I've always strongly identified with, and that I've been very proud of. When I was a teenager, I had a very unfortunate experience that hurt me very deeply, in which I was strongly condemned by my priesthood leaders and my parents for a mistake I had made. And I internalized that. And then after I had children of my own, when I was in my early 30s, I felt to know more of the nature of God by the experience of becoming a mother than I ever learned in any church meeting. And I realized that I would never treat one of my children that way. I would never reject them, and I would never condemn them, and I would love them no matter what. And it was only in my 30s that I realized that something very wrong had happened to me. And I became, for a time, very disillusioned and very bitter. And for the first time, stepped one foot outside of the boundaries of the church. And my husband and I went in to talk to our bishop at one point to tell him how we felt, and expecting to have him wield his priesthood authority over us. I was fully expecting him to stand from behind his desk and demand that we surrender our temple recommends to him right now. But he didn't. He just looked at us with love and said, "I understand that you're going through a hard time, but whatever you do, please don't lose your relationship with Jesus Christ." And those words from my bishop made my mind click that there might be a difference in my testimony between Jesus Christ and my testimony of the church. I had always lumped those two together, and I never knew that they could be separate things. And over the years, even though my testimony of the church has vacillated, though it has endured, my testimony of Jesus Christ has only ever been continually strengthened throughout the years. And I am a Mormon. But even more importantly, I am a follower and a disciple of Jesus Christ. And I want to bear testimony of him and his unconditional love for us. And I've realized over the years that I have been much more judgmental of Molly Mormons and Peter Priesthoods than they have been judgmental of me, who continually sets myself on the fringe. My two favorite scriptures are, one is from Timothy, paraphrasing, where it says that God has not put it in us the spirit to fear, but to have a strong and sound mind. And the other is in 2 Nephi, where through the atonement of Jesus Christ, we are given the power to act for ourselves and not to be acted upon. When I was in my 40s, I finally came to terms with what had happened when I was a teenager. And I had a prayer where I finally just totally gave it up to the Lord, and I was just sobbing and sobbing and just begging for forgiveness and to know once and for all that I was a good person and that I was clean before God. And I felt such a flooding of love from my Savior. And it was a feeling of love and understanding and acceptance. And instead of being forgiven of my sins, he said to me, "There's nothing to forgive. I love you." When I watched the It Gets Better video by the Brigham Young students, I was so impressed that many of those gay students, when they finally just let down their defenses and gave it all to the Lord, that they felt that same
absolute love and understanding and acceptance from God as I did that day, telling me that he loved me as I am and that there's nothing to forgive. I'm grateful for these types of places. I want to feel love in the alternative conversation about the church, not anger and bitterness. And I was glad to find that here today. And I end this bearing my testimony of Jesus Christ in his name. Amen. Hello? Okay, I can do that. I want to thank you, John, and the others who have had the courage and vision to make a space for a bigger kind of community than I know I certainly ever could have imagined growing up as a good Mormon girl, and a community that I desperately need. So thank you. I have far too much that I would love to share than there is time for, and so let me share a few thoughts and ask for a continued conversation of listening and sharing. I'm living a life that I never thought I would be living when I was growing up. I am divorced. I have only one child. I live alone. I'm a returned missionary who hasn't been to the temple for many, many years. My daughter was never baptized and does not have the experience of growing up in a Mormon community that loved her and taught her. I don't drive a station wagon, I drive a small Mazda Protege. But I want to express gratitude for the kinds of communities that have sustained me on this journey that I've been on, that I never expected to be on, and to say that that sustenance is part and parcel of what I'm experiencing here and feeling so grateful for, and that I thought was not really ever going to be possible again for me within any kind of Mormon realm. I am extremely grateful for music. The holiest experiences that I've had in my life have been when I've made music with other people. When I was in the Cambridge ward, when I lived here during graduate school, the best calling I ever had was to lead the ward choir. And my daughter was growing in my womb when I did that, and I just think it nutrified her. Living in Nashville, Tennessee for the last 13 years, which is Music City, not just for country music, gave me the chance to belong to a choir. A community choir gave me the chance to fall in love with a musician, gave me the chance to find other congregations where my daughter and I felt that we could fit in ways that we didn't feel we could in a Mormon congregation. I want to thank you, Mark, for the beauty that you brought to those hymns. I feel thankful as well for the openness of the church that Emma and I found together in Nashville, the Second Presbyterian Church, which was an open and affirming congregation where the minister was openly gay, where my Mormonism was embraced and seen as a welcome addition, where we had a Sunday school class called Living the Questions, a Sunday school class that I'd never, of a nature I'd never experienced, where everything was up for discussion and questioning, and most of all, where people reached out to us and really loved us. It never felt quite the same, though, and Laurel and Joanna have helped me understand a little bit more why. That to truly belong in many communities, we have to tell our personal stories, and in that congregation and in the Episcopal congregation that we also visited for a while, I missed testimony meeting, and I missed the hymns. The journey that brought me back here is a strange and perhaps fortuitous one, in that I'm able to blend old and new, to be in the same ward that I was in much younger, on, I think, different terms. I'm grateful to Carl and Karen for welcoming me, and to Gail and Laurel for the same, and to others in the ward. I think I've been kind of a mystery because I didn't come to church for a long time after I moved, and then all of a sudden I show up and I'm teaching a Sunday school class with Laurel Ulrich. How's that? And I don't really know what I'm going to do. But no one has called me in for an interview, and no one has seemed to question me, and I really appreciate that. I think the final thing that I want to express gratitude for is, I think the theology and the doctrine of pre-agency, and how my own daughter has taught me so much about it. One of the main reasons why we stopped going to the Mormon church was because she hated it. When she was six, I remember her looking at me and saying, "Mommy, why are there no girls passing the sacrament?" And I said, "We'll talk about it at home." And later, it was a miserable experience for her to go to church. And one Sunday we were talking about, I was telling her about what personal values of mine are affirmed or not affirmed by going to church. And she was very interested in that and made her own list of values. And basically very, very few of any of them were affirmed in her experience by going to church. And I thought I would test it a little bit. She was about 11. And I said, "Well, what about school? How many of these are affirmed by going to school?" I'm thinking maybe it's just like something you have to do. Didn't affirm her values. But there were more affirmed by school than by church. And at that point, I said, you know, to myself, the child has spoken. And for me to continue to force her to go to the Mormon church won't honor her agency. I was also aware that what I chose to do would be the equivalent of letting, to many Orthodox Mormons, would be the equivalent of letting your child stick her finger in the light socket. You know, the sin beyond the head of the parent and all that. And I still struggle with that. But I was not willing to force her to do something that I felt would violate her spiritually. So I don't have a traditional path, and she doesn't know the Book of Mormon stories. But I have been grateful to see that when she goes home to visit her dad in Nashville, she goes to Second Presbyterian Church. And there's something, I think, that she understands about community, even if not an Orthodox religious community. So again, there's many more things that I'd like to share, but I just want to thank you again for giving me a place to tell a story that I haven't told to Mormons ever. Thank you.
Brothers and sisters, I just wanted to take the opportunity today to get this off my chest. It's been a long time since I've been in front of a congregation and had the chance to bear my testimony. You know, someone today asked me, "Are you a Mormon? Is that why you're here today?" And for much of my life, I wasn't a Mormon. I'm a convert to the church, and I'm inactive. I came from a background, a Catholic background, and growing up, spirituality, religion, God, none of it made a lot of sense to me. I didn't have any answers. All I kind of knew is from the pictures on the wall, all those sculptures that were on the that lined the sides of the church that showed the resurrection sequence. And for me, it came to the day of First Communion after we had some education and we learned what was going on. To me, it was still a bit confusing, but I understood one thing. That Christ was important for me. And there was this presentation up in front of the church, and when we got our first communion, and the priest ran around with went around with a microphone, and he asked the different kids, and he said, "Well, you know, what does this part mean to you? Who's this person?" And he asked me, where does God come from? Where does Christ come from? And, you know, to me, just point bluntly, I said, "Well, he comes from the cemetery." And everybody just kind of stopped for a second, and they went, "The cemetery?" You know? And I said, "Yeah, he's always walking up from that crypt, and he's in white." And that resonated with me as a child. And I had family that, you know, they loved going to church. And I became an altar boy for a while. And I started asking a lot of questions. And for me, a lot beyond that, understanding that there was life after this one, a lot of it got fuzzy. Who God was, what he was. Everywhere, but not everywhere, and of substance, but not of substance. And to me, that there weren't a lot of answers, and I got kind of confused. And those answers, those questions, led me to Mormonism, and I started to get a lot of answers, and I got hungry for that. I started to be fed. And my spirit really felt nourished. It was like a crypt, if you will. If light started to cast in, and I followed the light, and my time that I spent with Mormons and the church was amazing, and I listened to the light that they had for me. The answers. When I decided to join the church, my family didn't follow me. They were against it. The church didn't make a lot of sense to them. But I gained a testimony in the Book of Mormon. I prayed about it. I felt something well up inside that this is where I was supposed to go to follow that light. And so I did so. And you know, it felt like I was leaving the pact, that this was a journey that had to be alone for a time, and I did that. And even there are plenty of times in Mormonism that I fell apart of something. But eventually that light disappeared, and I knew it was time for me to leave. You know, I'd like to just express that, you know, when I people ask me today when they said, well, are you a Mormon? I still consider myself a Mormon. And I had a testimony, and my testimony today is in that I know what it's like to be a pioneer. I know what it's like to have to go on a journey to a Zion. And to me, that's the Mormon experience. I never served a mission. I promised my parents when I was going to go into the church that I'd get done my college education. While I was there, I eventually got into BYU, and I learned so much. And I spent my time in the libraries, and I'd read all these books and try to get more and more answers. And that led me to confusion somehow. And here I was a pioneer, and I felt like I was traveling through the wilderness, and a great sandstorm came, and I couldn't see Zion any longer. I didn't know where I was going. And when I think that sandstorm was, it lasted a long time. And for me, when I started to download these podcasts, it was as if everything cleared and I knew where I needed to go again. And for me, that knowledge of knowing that I'm a pioneer and I'm going toward the Zion, this is a bit of that for me. And I'm grateful to have the story of stories that have from people that have led the way before me, that I kind of have a trail now. And even though I have I've trekked so much of the way alone myself, there's certain things about the Mormon experience I'll never know. I never got my endowments. Something I struggled with, and I was having my trial of faith all the way through college, and I never got that opportunity, and I never got the opportunity to serve a mission and those kind of things. So I can't relate in that regard. But for me, Mormonism is about traveling to Zion. And I hope when you talk about it with me that you'll know that that's my perspective. And I thank you for your friendship, and I'm thankful for John and putting a stake in the ground and saying that this is a place we all can meet and share our stories. And I'm so grateful for that. And I finally feel, once again, like I have a home. And I've felt many times like that's been absent in my life. And, you know, I'm grateful to be here this weekend and to hear your stories. And I just wanted to personally thank John and the people involved to put this together. And it's going to be a long journey. It's been a long journey already, but we can look back. We can see where we are from the peak of the mountain that we're on and look back and kind of say, it's been a rough road. And we still got a ways to climb, but we're all on this trek together. And thank you so much.
Good afternoon. My name is Dan Gardner. I've currently live in Fort Worth, Texas. Happened to be in Boston this weekend because I found a really cheap flight. So I booked it, and I happen to have someone I consider a dear friend. My favorite mission companion actually is here at Harvard Med. It worked out. He told me about Mormon stories up until about 2 days ago. I'd never heard of y'all. I had no idea what it was about, and I feel a little bad, a little guilty confessing this, but I even during our break when I was enjoying the most terrific pie I think I've ever had, I didn't quite get it. I wasn't quite sure what the point of this was. You know, and I even told I met a couple of new folks, and I even told them that, and I felt a little bad. You know, now if you don't subscribe to the belief, you know, if it's not something you believe in, then why is this cultural aspect still so important? How do you still hold that so near and dear to your heart? And I, looking at the afternoon session and seeing that they had an open mic, I thought, man, if there's anything, we all know that awkward moment sitting in a sacrament meeting when no one's getting up and you have 35 minutes to go and the bishop's just looking around. I just knew that's what we were going to have, only so much more compounded. You know, everyone's going, well, what, I don't even know what he believes, or I don't know what she... What's this person going to talk about? You know, but it hasn't been awkward. It's been incredible, and I thank you for that. That's incredible. I think by most accounts I would be considered a very run of the mill Mormon. I am active in church. I am straight. I am married. I have I'm having children. I'm very run of the mill. I do have a testimony. I believe in Jesus Christ. I do believe what Joseph Smith said and many of the things that he taught. I believe those things. I come from a family, however, that I was certainly raised LDS, and I have five sisters and a little brother that's on a mission now. My dad was a bishop growing up, and it just seemed to me like we were a very, again, run-of-the-mill kind of family. In high school, things started to unravel a little bit. It turns out my father wasn't what we thought he was. He'd been a bishop. He had been a church member. He'd been an elected official, and turns out he was a closet alcoholic. Turns out he was abusing prescription medication. Turns out there were just so many things that I thought I knew about him that were false, and there were so many things that I could never even imagined about him that turned out to be true. And it was one of the difficulties for me was that he continually called himself a Mormon, and people would sometimes accuse him as such, and he was proud to admit that. And I, like a lot of teenagers, you know, people would tell me all the time how I looked like my dad, and oh, I talked to people like my dad, and oh, and I just wanted nothing more than to absolutely distance myself, to get away from that as much as possible, get as far away. I served a mission, and he wrote me every week. I read very few of those letters, and I certainly didn't write him back. I came home, and we've certainly talked since, but we don't have much of a relationship to speak of. He continues to call himself a Mormon. And this conference, this afternoon, hearing from you, has made a difference. And time will certainly tell if that's a lasting difference. But I feel right now in this moment that I understand him a little more. That that I get it a little more after hearing your experiences and and your desires to be considered and to still be part of the group and to have those relationships. I think I understand my dad a little better than I ever have before. And as a very run-of-the-mill Mormon, I can tell you, I certainly wouldn't think to speak for the church, but I can speak for myself that I am so honored that you would still want to be associated with the church. I'm so honored that you would want to tie yourself to me and tie yourself to the other members and to maintain that relationship. I think that's so beautiful. What an incredible opportunity. I'll certainly be listening to podcasts in the future and find out what you're all about. But I'm grateful to have come. I'm glad for good friends who encouraged me to do so, and that's my story. Thanks.
Okay, my husband's probably shocked that I'm standing here. I come to this conference because I'm supporting my husband, who has stopped attending after struggling for many years. But it's reminded me of an experience that I had probably closer to when he started questioning whether he still believed. And I was sitting actually in general conference, and I was like, man, he should just go to the bishop. He needs to fix this. He needs to figure this out and get it all fixed. And as I was sitting there, I got a very distinct feeling that maybe I needed to go to the bishop and figure out what my issues were. And I started, probably no one intended to cry. I wasn't going to. Determined facade that I have to carry all the time. So sorry. I realized slowly but surely how many things I did not understand. The feminism within me that my father tried to squish and still worries about. One of his last phone calls I had with him, he's worried about me leaving the church because I got a graduate degree. And maybe he should, I don't know. But, you know, I have really embraced the fact that I have so many doubts, and yet I still love this church. It's how I connect with the divine. And so, about a year ago, different circumstances happened. I just thought, maybe I can't keep going, even though I love it so much. I can't find the community there. Because people don't like that so I'm the run-of-the-mill, drive the minivan mom. I even homeschool. It's like everything I do, but I hate doing dishes, and I hate cooking, and I don't fit that model, and it's so hard. And I know, and I keep praying, like, what's the plan, God? And God's like, you've got kids. This is what my plan is, and it'll all work out. So I stay, and I try. Actually, I don't cook anymore. It's all divvied out between my kids and my husband for sanity purposes. But when I was considering leaving the church, and my husband was chiding me that I couldn't leave the church because people hurt my feelings or didn't want to include me, because there were so many better reasons. But I was considering it. And I realized through some different experiences that the Spirit still spoke to me, and this church was mine. And the love and because the church is supposed to be about love. It's supposed to be about acceptance. It's supposed to be about helping us all come to God. That's what it's all about. And so Mormonism is mine, and I claim it. And I go, and I'm not a quiet voice anymore. I mean, I used to like be a voice that was like all affirming. Now I'm the voice that says, I don't have a testimony of that scripture in Ephesians that I'm supposed to submit to my husband. I do not have a testimony of that. So, and I don't have a testimony of polygamy, and I don't have a testimony of blacks, like the whole band, Black Summer. I don't have a testimony. And you know why? That's okay. Because God will lead me to that knowledge. And so I stand up and I say, I am an at-home mom, but I struggle every single day with it. And I do it because I feel like this is what's right for me right now. And that's okay. And it is amazing every single time I do that. Every single time someone comes up to me, men and women, and say, thank you for being honest. And so I'll continue to be honest and continue to make Mormonism what I know it can be. And I will teach my children to also be voices. And the young women, branch presidents, we're in a branch. He's probably sorry he called me, but they'll know all this stuff. And in a good, loving way that we should embrace and love one another. And I'm grateful for this community, even though sometimes I get mad that my husband has to talk about it all the time. I'm grateful for this, and for Mormon Matters has been a real godsend for me. And I'm grateful for these things. I'm grateful that we're all here and that I came today. And thank you. And you can-
Thank you all so very, very much. It was an honor to hear all of your stories. We are going to sing all together now the hymn For the Beauty of the Earth, and then we're going to close with a traditional prayer offered by Luke Langford.
A quick announcement. So since this is non-traditional, I'm going to call an audible here and make two requests. Number one, we're going to do away with the traditional but highly useless position of chorister. So I don't know if you were planning on doing that, but have a seat, and I think you'll find it works just fine without anyone flapping their arms around.
I was just going to follow you anyway.
Yeah, no, you're good. And number two, I'm going to request that we all stand up, because you stand to sing hymns. And this reminds me of a story, you can wait a second, that my friend Winston Tao tells, and many of you probably know him, about the first time he went to a Mormon church. And so, you know, he was sitting in the pew, and the first hymn came up, and he stood up and realized he was like the only person standing up, so he quickly sat down again. And then the second hymn came around, and he sort of resisted the urge to stand up. And just when he thought he had it all figured out, the third hymn came around, and everybody else stood up except for him, and it was highly confusing. So we're going to stand and sing three verses.
Thank you. Our dear Heavenly Father, we are very grateful that we've had the opportunity today to all gather here for this Mormon Stories Conference. I'm grateful to those who helped organize it. I'm grateful also to John and others who helped start this podcast to help us better understand this faith and its history. We're grateful for the blessings that thou bestows upon us and thy love and the Spirit which we can feel. And we pray that as we've been able to be here today and listen to the stories that have been shared, that we'll be able to reflect and understand how we can each be more authentic, understand what we believe, and understand how we can draw ourselves closer to thee. Grateful again for this, and pray that we'll be able to preserve some of the relationships we've built today and this weekend. And these things we say in the name of thy Son, Jesus Christ. Amen.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. Music today was provided by the Saber Rattlers. Check them out at saber-rattlers.com. The Mormon Stories logo was generously donated by StudioCase.com. Thanks for listening.
Come, come, ye saints, no toil nor labor fear, but with joy wend your way. Though hard to you this journey may appear, grace shall be as your day. Better far for us to strive our useless cares from us to drive, to the sand joy hearts will swell. Oh, all is well, all is well. Journey's through, happy day.